episode 53. But I'm too young for real memory loss. Well, hello. I'm 40 and I'm stupid. How are you? Oh, my dear. I have been trying to find the time to re-record episode 52. And when I finally had amassed all of the pieces of information that I had put into the original chapter or episode 52, I finally had time tonight to sit down and actually record. And I went to save the file, and I decided instead of opening what should have been episode 52, this corrupted file that was really episode 51, I went back and opened episode 51, thinking, well, that's a cleaner file. I'll be able to save over that, and it'll be easy. And I accidentally started playing part of it and said, wait a minute, those are Becky Crackle's chapters. Oh, dear Lord. And I went back to the beginning, and what did I hear at the beginning? Episode 52. I couldn't believe it. I was horrified. So I have combined the show notes for episodes 52 and episodes 53. And I'm so sorry. So what it means is you have episode 52, where I talk all about things that hadn't quite happened yet, and I'm posting it after all of those things happened, which is confusing for me, but probably not so confusing for you, because you might not be listening to this in real time. I had lovely emails from so many of you saying, don't worry about the podcast, have a good birthday. And I did, I really did. It was just wonderful. So in the meantime, life went on, and when I came back, I got a bunch of emails, and one of them was from Jenna, who sent in a link to a piece of knitting that a woman did for a theatrical show of Tale of Two Cities. She had to do two different knitted swatches that would look like Madame Defarge's code. And it's all done in black and white. It looks like a stocking, but the code is really quite something. And I think from the audience, it would have looked very mysterious and very code-like. So thank you to Jenna, who I think she said she was just kind of looking around on the blog for Fair Isle knitting and came across this. And it's a stunning piece of Fair Isle. So thanks, Jenna, for that one. There's a link to that on the show notes. I also am going to put a link up to a short story that, it's not that short, it's a long short story, that my friend Nina, my golem friend Nina, sent me months ago. Dear God, it was the end of March. And it's somebody's blog who writes fiction on their blog, but they did a fiction piece about an executioner and his family in the French Revolution. And we're getting closer to the real start of the French Revolution. In fact, we're not all that far. I'm looking at the chapter titles. Oh, it'll be sometime in June, I think, that we'll probably get to it. Well, no, that one's a really long chapter. June or early July, we'll get to the revolution. And it's pretty disturbing when you start thinking about what these guys who ran the guillotine must have gone through and how hard it must have been. And I think I mentioned it before, but the movie Marie Antoinette that Kirsten Dunst was in, my husband and I watched it, and it's not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but it's good and it's interesting, and it gives you a really good visual for what the aristocracy was living in. You never see outside the aristocracy. But between these two pieces, the one on the executioner and the Marie Antoinette movie, and then what you get from Dickens, I think I'm starting to piece together a fairly interesting picture of life back then. And I'm really glad I live now. Global warming aside, I kind of prefer it right now. So, with that having been said, I just posted episode 52, which did chapters 10 and 11. And that gave you the two pictures. You've got Manet and Charles Darnay, who kind of dispassionately but very clearly declares his love for Lucy. And then we had Stryver, who's just pompous, and Carton, who's funny. And tonight, we get another pairing. The first chapter, chapter 12, is called A Fellow of Delicacy, and that is big ol' irony, because it's about Stryver, and Stryver is nothing if not indelicate. He's kind of a buffoon. I'm sure he'd be horrified to hear me say that, but the man's a buffoon, and he's not very nice, actually, in this chapter. He reminds me of those guys who will say things like, oh, she was asking for it. And I think he has too much decorum to actually cross a line and do something bad about it. But he does kind of have that attitude. On the other hand, in the same chapter, we get to see some Mr. Lorry. And as you know, from the very first chapters, I found Mr. Lorry charming. And the whole thing that he was talking about before about, you know, I'm a man of business, I'm not a man of family, I'm not a man of emotion. Listen to how he responds to what Stryver says about Lucy. He's just beautiful and so diplomatic and so kind and understanding and paternal. And I just love Mr. Lorry. I do. I can't deny it. I'd run away with him. Well, I don't know what he looks like, but I'm sure he's very nice. And then we have chapter 12, Fellow of Delicacy, and then chapter 13, A Fellow of No Delicacy. And this, of course, is ironic again. Although at first glance, it looks like it's probably literal, because this chapter is about Sydney Carton. Finally, we get to see inside Sydney Carton, and we see the love triangle develop that, of course, you need in any good twisted romance. We have Charles Darnay, Lucy Manette, and Sydney Carton. And at least Darnay and Carton love Lucy. We don't really know what's going on with Lucy yet. We haven't heard anything specific. But we do get to see inside Sydney Carton's heart in chapter 13, and it hurts. It's not happy. Not that you probably thought he was a particularly jovial person on the inside, but it's interesting because it kind of sets up a pairing. Again, the whole book is about dualities and pairs and, you know, two sides of the same coin. Carton talks about himself very much like Dr. Manette, about kind of being imprisoned, but this time in himself, in his dissolute lifestyle, that he's too weak to pull himself out of it. He has no hope. He's not strong enough to be recalled to life, that kind of thing. But that's one of the things that this book is about. It's about revolution, you know, people deciding that they're going to do something different than what they've been doing. And then it's also about resurrection. It's about what happens next. You know, who is the new you? How are you reborn? And that's a really important thing to keep in mind, certainly during today's chapters, but also in the next few chapters that we get into, is change is about to happen. And what was that quote that Jefferson had? The tree of liberty must be watered time to time by the blood of patriots. I think he probably would have rescinded that at some point, but it's that same idea that in order to keep things fresh, you know, you have to spill blood, and whether it's metaphoric blood or literal blood, it's that idea that, you know, something has to end in order for something to be reborn. And what it would take for Sydney to give up his lifestyle would be extraordinary and possibly impossible for him. And that's sad, you know. You never want to write anyone off, not even Sydney Carton. So those are our chapters for today. And I think I've managed to patch everything back together after having it all fall apart last week. Oh, the Rosalind the Roseline Church, the Roslyn Church up in Scotland. I think I mentioned last time that my sister found a link to where they had figured out what the some of the carvings on the walls meant. She also found a video of those parts of the church. And so if you are interested, I have put a link in the show notes to this YouTube video, which is quite lengthy, but also very interesting and very pretty, and a little bit older than the time period that we're working on, but I didn't want to forget. So I'm going to stop blathering. I have for you today chapters 12 and 13, A Fellow of Delicacy and A Fellow of No Delicacy, from Charles Dickens, A Tale of Two Cities.
Book 2, Chapter 12, of A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Paul Adams. Chapter 12, The Fellow of Delicacy. Mr. Stryver, having made up his mind to that magnanimous bestowal of good fortune on the doctor's daughter, resolved to make her happiness known to her before he left town for the long vacation. After some mental debating of the point, he came to the conclusion that it would be as well to get all the preliminaries done with, and they could then arrange at their leisure whether he should give her his hand a week or two before Michaelmas term, or in the little Christmas vacation between it and Hilary. As to the strength of his case, he had not a doubt about it, but clearly saw his way to the verdict. Argued with the jury on substantial worldly grounds, the only grounds ever worth taking into account, it was a plain case, and had not a weak spot in it. He called himself for the plaintiff. There was no getting over his evidence. The counsel for the defendant threw up his brief, and the jury did not even turn to consider. After trying it, Stryver, C.J., was satisfied that no plainer case could be. Accordingly, Mr. Stryver inaugurated the long vacation with a formal proposal to take Miss Manette to Vauxhall Gardens, that failing, to Ranelagh, that unaccountably failing too, it behoved him to present himself in Soho and there declare his noble mind. Towards Soho, therefore, Mr. Stryver shouldered his way from the Temple, while the bloom of the long vacation's infancy was still upon it. Anybody who had seen him projecting himself into Soho while he was yet on St. Dunstan's side of Temple Bar, bursting in his full-blown way along the pavement to the jostlement of all weaker people, might have seen how safe and strong he was. His way taking him past Tellson's, and he both banking at Tellson's and knowing Mr. Lorry as the intimate friend of the Manettes, it entered Mr. Stryver's mind to enter the bank and reveal to Mr. Lorry the brightness of the Soho horizon. So he pushed open the door with the weak rattle in its throat, stumbled down the two steps, got past the two ancient cashiers, and shouldered himself into the musty back closet where Mr. Lorry sat at great books ruled for figures, with perpendicular iron bars to his window, as if that were ruled for figures too, and everything under the clouds were a sum.
"Halloa!" said Mr. Stryver. "How do you do? I hope you are well."
It was Stryver's grand peculiarity that he always seemed too big for any place or space. He was so much too big for Tellson's that old clerks in distant corners looked up with looks of remonstrance, as though he squeezed them against the wall. The house itself, magnificently reading the paper quite in the far-off perspective, lowered displeased, as if the Stryver head had been butted into its responsible waistcoat. The discreet Mr. Lorry said, in a sample tone of the voice he would recommend under the circumstances, "How do you do, Mr. Stryver?"
"How do you do, sir?" and shook hands. There was a peculiarity in his manner of shaking hands, always to be seen in any clerk at Tellson's who shook hands with a customer when the house pervaded the air. He shook in a self-abnegating way, as one who shook for Tellson and Company.
"Can I do anything for you, Mr. Stryver?" asked Mr. Lorry in his business character.
"Why, no, thank you. This is a private visit to yourself, Mr. Lorry. I have come for a private word." "Oh, indeed," said Mr. Lorry, bending down his ear while his eye strayed to the house afar off.
"I am going," said Mr. Stryver, leaning his arms confidentially on the desk, whereupon, although it was a large double one, there appeared to be not half desk enough for him. "I am going to make an offer of myself in marriage to your agreeable little friend, Miss Manette, Mr. Lorry."
"Oh, dear me," cried Mr. Lorry, rubbing his chin and looking at his visitor dubiously.
"Oh, dear me, sir," repeated Stryver, drawing back. "Oh, dear you, sir, what may your meaning be, Mr. Lorry?"
"My meaning," answered the man of business, "is of course friendly and appreciative, and that it does you the greatest credit, and, in short, my meaning is everything you could desire. But really, you know, Mr. Stryver..." Mr. Lorry paused and shook his head at him in the oddest manner, as if he were compelled against his will to add internally, "You know, there really is so much, too much of you."
"Well," said Stryver, slapping the desk with his contentious hand, opening his eyes wider and taking a long breath, "if I understand you, Mr. Lorry, I'll be hanged."
Mr. Lorry adjusted his little wig at both ears as a means towards that end, and bit the feather of a pen.
"Damn it all, sir," said Stryver, staring at him, "am I not eligible?"
"Oh, dear, yes, yes, oh, yes, you're eligible," said Mr. Lorry. "If you say eligible, you are eligible."
"Am I not prosperous?" asked Stryver.
"Oh, if you come to prosperous, you are prosperous," said Mr. Lorry.
"And advancing?"
"If you come to advancing, you know," said Mr. Lorry, delighted to be able to make another admission, "nobody can doubt that."
"Then what on earth is your meaning, Mr. Lorry?" demanded Stryver, perceptibly crestfallen.
"Well, I... were you going there now?" asked Mr. Lorry.
"Straight," said Stryver, with a plump of his fist on the desk.
"Then I think I wouldn't if I was you."
"Why?" said Stryver. "Now, I'll put you in a corner," forensically shaking a forefinger at him. "You are a man of business and bound to have a reason. State your reason. Why wouldn't you go?"
"Because," said Mr. Lorry, "I wouldn't go on such an object without having some cause to believe that I should succeed."
"Damn me!" cried Stryver. "But this beats everything."
Mr. Lorry glanced at the distant house and glanced at the angry Stryver.
"Here's a man of business, a man of years, a man of experience in a bank," said Stryver. "And having summed up three leading reasons for complete success, he says there's no reason at all. Says it with his head on."
Mr. Stryver remarked upon the peculiarity as if it would have been infinitely less remarkable if he had said it with his head off. "When I speak of success, I speak of success with the young lady, and when I speak of causes and reasons to make success probable, I speak of causes and reasons that will tell as such with the young lady. The young lady, my good sir," said Mr. Lorry, mildly tapping the Stryver arm, the young lady goes before all."
"Then you mean to tell me, Mr. Lorry,"
said Stryver, squaring his elbows, "that it is your deliberate opinion that the young lady at present in question is a mincing fool?"
"Not exactly so. I mean to tell you, Mr. Stryver," said Mr. Lorry, reddening,
"that I will hear no disrespectful word of that young lady from any lips, and that if I knew any man, which I hope I do not, whose taste was so coarse and whose temper was so overbearing that he could not restrain himself from speaking disrespectfully of that young lady at this desk, not even Tellson should prevent my giving him a piece of my mind."
The necessity of being angry in a suppressed tone had put Mr. Stryver's blood vessels into a dangerous state when it was his turn to be angry.
Mr. Lorry's veins, methodical as their courses could usually be, were in no better state now it was his turn.
"That is what I mean to tell you, sir," said Mr. Lorry. "Pray let there be no mistake about it."
Mr. Stryver sucked the end of a ruler for a little while, and then stood hitting a tune out of his teeth with it, which probably gave him the toothache. He broke the awkward silence by saying, "This is something new to me, Mr. Lorry. You deliberately advised me not to go up to Soho and offer myself, Stryver of the King's Bench Bar?"
"Do you ask me for my advice, Mr. Stryver?"
"Yes, I do."
"Very good. Then I give it, and you have repeated it correctly."
"And all I can say of it is," laughed Stryver with a vexed laugh, "that this beats everything, past, present, and to come."
"Now understand me," pursued Mr. Lorry. "As a man of business, I am not justified in saying anything about this matter, for, as a man of business, I know nothing of it. But as an old fellow who has carried Miss Manette in his arms, who is the trusted friend of Miss Manette, and of her father too, and who has a great affection for them both, I have spoken. The confidence is not of my seeking, recollect. Now, you think I may not be right?"
"Not I," said Stryver, whistling. "I can't undertake to find third parties in common sense. I can only find it for myself. I suppose sense in certain quarters. You suppose mincing bread and butter nonsense. It's new to me, but you are right, I dare say."
"What I suppose, Mr. Stryver, I claim to characterise for myself. And understand me, sir," said Mr. Lorry, quickly flushing again,
"I will not even at Tellson's, have it characterised for me by any gentleman breathing." "There, I beg your pardon," said Stryver.
"Granted, thank you. Well, Mr. Stryver, I was about to say, it might be painful to you to find yourself mistaken. It might be painful to Dr. Manette to have the task of being explicit with you. It might be very painful to Miss Manette to have the task of being explicit with you. You know the terms upon which I have the honour and happiness to stand with the family. If you please, committing you in no way, representing you in no way, I will undertake to correct my advice by the exercise of a little new observation and judgment expressly brought to bear upon it. If you should then be dissatisfied with it, you can but test its soundness for yourself. If, on the other hand, you should be satisfied with it, and it should be what it now is, it may spare all sides what is best spared. What do you say?"
"How long would you keep me in town?"
"Oh, it's only a question of a few hours. I could go to Soho in the evening and come to your chambers afterwards."
"Then I say yes," said Stryver. "I won't go up there now. I'm not so hot upon it as that comes to. I say yes, and I shall expect you to look in tonight. Good morning."
Then Mr. Stryver turned and burst out of the bank, causing such a concussion of air on his passage through that to stand up against it bowing behind the two counters required the utmost remaining strength of the two ancient clerks. Those venerable and feeble persons were always seen by the public in the act of bowing, and were popularly believed, when they had bowed a customer out, still to keep on bowing in the empty office until they bowed another customer in. The barrister was keen enough to divine that the banker would not have gone so far in his expression of opinion on any less solid ground than moral certainty. Unprepared as he was for the large pill he had to swallow, he got it down.
"And now," said Mr. Stryver, shaking his forensic forefinger at the temple in general, when it was down, "my way out of this is to put you all in the wrong."
It was a bit of the art of an Old Bailey tactician, in which he found great relief.
"You shall not put me in the wrong, young lady," said Mr. Stryver. "I'll do that for you."
Accordingly, when Mr. Lorry called that night as late as 10 o'clock, Mr. Stryver, among a quantity of books and papers littered out for the purpose, seemed to have nothing less on his mind than the subject of the morning. He even showed surprise when he saw Mr. Lorry, and was altogether in an absent and preoccupied state.
"Well," said that good-natured emissary, after a full half-hour of bootless attempts to bring him round to the question, "I've been to Soho."
"To Soho?" repeated Mr. Stryver coldly.
"Oh, to be sure, what am I thinking of?"
"And I have no doubt," said Mr. Lorry, "that I was right in the conversation we had. My opinion is confirmed, and I reiterate my advice."
"I assure you," returned Mr. Stryver, in the friendliest way, "that I am sorry for it on your account, and sorry for it on the poor father's account. I know this must always be a sore subject with the family. Let us say no more about it."
"I don't understand you," said Mr. Lorry.
"I dare say not," rejoined Stryver, nodding his head in a smoothing and final way. "No matter, no matter."
"But it does matter," Mr. Lorry urged.
"No, it doesn't. I assure you it doesn't. Having supposed that there was sense where there is no sense, and a laudable ambition where there is not a laudable ambition, I am well out of my mistake, and no harm is done. Young women have committed similar foibles often before, and have repented them in poverty and obscurity often before. In an unselfish aspect, I am sorry that the thing is dropped, because it would have been a bad thing for me in a worldly point of view. In a selfish aspect, I am glad that the thing is dropped, because it would have been a bad thing for me in a worldly point of view. It is hardly necessary to say I could have gained nothing by it. There is no harm at all done. I have not proposed to the young lady, and, between ourselves, I am by no means certain, on reflection, that I ever should have committed myself to that extent. Mr. Lorry, you cannot control the mincing vanities and giddiness of empty-headed girls. You must not expect to do it, or you will always be disappointed. Now, pray say no more about it. I tell you, I regret it on account of others, but I am satisfied on my own account. And I am really very much obliged to you for allowing me to sound you, and for giving me your advice. You know the young lady better than I do. You were right. It never would have done."
Mr. Lorry was so taken aback that he looked quite stupidly at Mr. Stryver, shouldering him towards the door, with an appearance of showering generosity, forbearance, and goodwill on his erring head.
"Make the best of it, my dear sir," said Stryver. "Say no more about it. Thank you again for allowing me to sound you. Good night."
Mr. Lorry was out in the night before he knew where he was. Mr. Stryver was lying back on his sofa, winking at his ceiling. End of Book 2, Chapter 12. Chapter 13, The Fellow of No Delicacy. If Sidney Carton ever shone anywhere, he certainly never shone in the house of Dr. Manette. He had been there often, during a whole year, and had always been the same moody and morose lounger there. When he cared to talk, he talked well, but the cloud of caring for nothing, which overshadowed him with such a fatal darkness, was very rarely pierced by the light within him. And yet he did care something for the streets that environed that house, and for the senseless stones that made their pavements. Many a night he vaguely and unhappily wandered there, when wine had brought no transitory gladness to him. Many a dreary daybreak revealed his solitary figure lingering there, and still lingering there, when the first beams of the sun, brought into strong relief, removed beauties of architecture in spires of churches and lofty buildings, as perhaps the quiet time brought some sense of better things, else forgotten and unattainable, into his mind. Of late, the neglected bed in the Temple Court had known him more scantily than ever, and often, when he had thrown himself upon it no longer than a few minutes, he had got up again and haunted that neighbourhood. On a day in August, when Mr. Stryver, after notifying to his jackal that he had thought better of that marrying matter, had carried his delicacy into Devonshire, and when the sight and scent of flowers in the city streets had some waifs of goodness in them for the worst, of health for the sickliest, and of youth for the oldest, Sidney's feet still trod those stones. From being irresolute and purposeless, his feet became animated by an intention, and in the working out of that intention they took him to the doctor's door. He was shown upstairs and found Lucy at her work, alone. She had never been quite at her ease with him, and received him with some little embarrassment as he seated himself near her table. but, looking up at his face in the interchange of the first few commonplaces, she observed a change in it.
"I fear you are not well, Mr. Carton."
"No, but the life I lead, Miss Manette, is not conducive to health. What is to be expected of, or by, such profligates?
Is it not, forgive me, I have begun the question on my lips, a pity to live no better life?"
"God knows it is a shame."
"Then why not change it?"
Looking gently at him again, she was surprised and saddened to see that there were tears in his eyes. There were tears in his voice, too, as he answered,
"It is too late for that. I shall never be better than I am. I shall sink lower and be worse."
He leaned an elbow on her table and covered his eyes with his hand. The table trembled in the silence that followed. She had never seen him softened, and was much distressed. He knew her to be so, without looking at her, and said,
"Pray forgive me, Miss Manette. I break down before the knowledge of what I want to say to you. Will you hear me?"
"If it will do you any good, Mr. Carton, if it would make you happier, it would make me very glad."
"God bless you for your sweet compassion."
He unshaded his face after a little while and spoke steadily. "Don't be afraid to hear me. Don't shrink from anything I say. I am like one who died young. All my life might have been."
"No, Mr. Carton, I'm sure that the best part of it might still be. I'm sure that you might be much, much worthier of yourself."
"Say of you, Miss Manette, and although I know better, although in the mystery of my own wretched heart I know better, I shall never forget it."
She was pale and trembling. He came to her relief with a fixed despair of himself, which made the interview unlike any other that could have been holden.
"If it had been possible, Miss Manette, that you could have returned the love of the man you see before you, flung away, wasted, drunken, poor creature of misuse, as you know him to be, he would have been conscious this day and hour, in spite of his happiness, that he would bring you to misery, bring you to sorrow and repentance, blight you, disgrace you, pull you down with him. I know very well that you can have no tenderness for me. I ask for none. I am even thankful that it cannot be."
"Without it, can I not save you, Mr. Carton? Can I not recall you, forgive me again, to a better course? Can I in no way repay your confidence? I know this is a confidence," she modestly said, after a little hesitation, and in earnest tears. "I know you would say this to no one else. Can I turn it to no good account for yourself, Mr. Carton?"
He shook his head.
"To none. No, Miss Manette, to none. If you will hear me through a very little more, all you can ever do for me is done. I wish you to know that you have been the last dream of my soul. In my degradation, I have not been so degraded but that the sight of you with your father and of this home made such a home by you has stirred old shadows that I thought had died out of me. Since I knew you, I have been troubled by a remorse that I thought would never reproach me again, and have heard whispers from old voices impelling me upward that I thought were silent for ever. I have had unformed ideas of striving afresh, beginning anew, shaking off sloth and sensuality, and fighting out the abandoned fight, a dream, all a dream that ends in nothing and leaves the sleeper where he lays down. But I wish you to know that you inspired it." "Will nothing of it remain? Oh, Mr. Carton, think again, try again."
"No, Miss Manette. All through it, I have known myself to be quite undeserving. And yet I have had the weakness, and have still the weakness, to wish you to know with what a sudden mastery you kindled me, heap of ashes that I am, into fire. A fire, however inseparable in its nature from myself, quickening nothing, lighting nothing, doing no service, idly burning away.
Since it is my misfortune, Mr. Carton, to have made you more unhappy than you were before you knew me..."
"Don't say that, Miss Manette, for you would have reclaimed me, if anything could. You will not be the cause of my becoming worse." Since the state of your mind that you describe is, at all events, attributable to some influence of mine, this is what I mean, if I can make it plain. Can I use no influence to serve you? Have I no power for good with you at all?
The utmost good that I am capable of now, Miss Manette, I have come here to realize. Let me carry through the rest of my misdirected life the remembrance that I opened my heart to you, last of all the world, and that there was something left in me at this time which you could deplore and pity,
which I entreated you to believe again and again, most fervently with all my heart, was capable of better things, Mr. Carton.
Entreat me to believe it no more, Miss Manette. I have proved myself, and I know better. I distress you. I draw fast to an end. Will you let me believe, when I recall this day, that the last confidence of my life was reposed in your pure and innocent breast, and that it lies there alone and will be shared by no one?
If that will be a consolation to you, yes.
Not even by the dearest one ever to be known to you?
Mr. Carton, she answered after an agitated pause, the secret is yours, not mine, and I promise to respect it.
Thank you, and again, God bless you.
He put her hand to his lips and moved towards the door.
Be under no apprehension, Miss Manette, of my ever resuming this conversation by so much as a passing word. I will never refer to it again. If I were dead, that could not be surer than it is henceforth. In the hour of my death, I shall hold sacred the one good remembrance, and shall thank and bless you for it, that my last avowal of myself was made to you, and that my name and faults and miseries were gently carried in your heart. May it otherwise be light and happy.
He was so unlike what he had ever shown himself to be, and it was so sad to think how much he had thrown away, and how much he every day kept down and perverted, that Lucy Manette wept mournfully for him as he stood looking back at her.
Be comforted, he said. I am not worth such feeling, Miss Manette. An hour or two hence, and the low companions and low habits that I scorn but yield to will render me less worth such tears as those than any wretch who creeps along the streets. Be comforted, but within myself I shall always be towards you what I am now, though outwardly I shall be what you have heretofore seen me. The last supplication but one I make to you is that you will believe this of me.
I will, Mr. Carton.
My last supplication of all is this, and with it I will relieve you of a visitor with whom I well know you have nothing in unison, and between whom and you there is an impassable space. It is useless to say it, I know, but it rises out of my soul. For you, and any dear to you, I would do anything. If my career were of that better kind that there was any opportunity or capacity of sacrifice in it, I would embrace any sacrifice for you and for those dear to you. Try to hold me in your mind some quiet times as ardent and sincere in this one thing. The time will come, the time will not be long in coming, when new ties will be formed about you, ties that will bind you yet more tenderly and strongly to the home you so adorn, the dearest ties that will ever grace and gladden you. Oh, Miss Manette, when the little picture of a happy father's face looks up in yours, when you see your own bright beauty springing up anew at your feet, think now and then that there is a man who would give his life to keep a life you love beside you. He said, farewell, said a last, God bless you, and left her. End of Book 2, Chapter 13.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.